Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 160 for August 30th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
It's become a part of our lives, how we celebrate our births and our deaths and our weddings and all of our significant events. The cocktail is really it's almost a metaphor for the American people.
That's veteran mixologist Dale DeGroff, one of the masterminds behind the Museum of the American Cocktail. It's just reopened in New Orleans, 3 years after Hurricane Katrina forced it out of the city, and just as another storm is taking aim on the Gulf Coast. More with Dale in a few minutes. First, though, let's look at the week's news. The Glendronach deal is complete. As expected, Pernod Ricard is selling the distillery to the investor group behind Benriach Distillery. The deal was announced this past week, but no terms were disclosed. Earlier reports put the price tag in the range of 15 million pounds, or about $28 million at current exchange rates. More financial news now. Brown-Forman reported its first profit declines in more than a year this past week. Sales fell on price increases for Jack Daniel's and the worldwide economic slump. And the company had to write off the value of dead and dying agave plants at its newly acquired Herradura tequila division. Good thing whiskey doesn't depend on plants. Oh, wait a second. Rising costs for barley and other grains are expected to cut into Diageo's profits in the coming year. Diageo reported a 9% increase in profits for the fiscal year ending in June, but projected 2009 profit increases of between 7 and 9% on inflation and a weaker economy in Europe. By the way, Johnnie Walker worldwide sales jumped 12% during the year to more than £1 billion. It's the first premium drinks brand to break that mark. 2 weeks ago, attendees at the Whiskey Fringe in Edinburgh voted on their favorite whiskeys of the weekend. The winner was the Bal Blair 1989 vintage, followed by the Brooklattie 18-year-old second edition and the Glenfarclas 30-year-old. Rounding out the top five, the Dalmore King Alexander Malt and the Compass Box Hedonism 2008 Grain Whiskey. The Whiskey Fringe is sponsored by Royal Mile Whiskies. A couple of emails from the inbox. Longtime WhiskeyCast listener Tom Maufer had a comment on the last episode's interview with James Espy and Tom Jago from The Last Drop. He said he'd love to have a dram with those guys because they know how to enjoy life and make business fun. Another longtime listener, Steve McGee, had a suggestion for a future episode. He wants to hear from some of the specialist whiskey retailers in the U.S. about their experiences in getting rare whiskeys to sell, especially when distribution is limited or imports aren't even available because of the U.S. bottle size limits. That's an idea I will be pursuing for an episode later this fall, Steve. If you have comments or suggestions, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. You can also leave feedback on the WhiskeyCast page in the iTunes Music Store or at your favorite podcast site and help new listeners find the show, too. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. First off, Whiskey Live Paris, sponsored by La Maison de Whiskey, is September 20th and 21st. I'll be on hand for special coverage from Paris that weekend. It's also the first of 2 weekends for the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival. The Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival is September 26th through the 29th. Whiskey Messen in Copenhagen is October 4th, and that weekend also features the Whiskey Weekend Bremen in Bremen, Germany, and Whiskey Live in Barcelona. Whiskey Fest San Francisco is October 10th, and the Milano Whiskey Festival is October 18th and 19th. Whiskey Live in Toronto is October 24th, followed by the Lindoris Whiskey Society's Whiskey Fest in Lindoris, Belgium, on the 25th and 26th. Whiskey Live Glasgow is October 31st and November 1st, and Whiskey Fest New York is November 11th. Believe it or not, those are just a few of the events over the next couple of months. You'll find a complete calendar of events on the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at laphroaig.com. 3 years ago this weekend, New Orleans was underwater and much of the U.S. Gulf Coast was in ruins after Hurricane Katrina. The storm claimed 1,800 lives and changed the city of New Orleans forever. But the city is recovering now, and a small sign of that recovery took place a few weeks ago when the Museum of the American Cocktail reopened. Dale DeGroff is one of the museum's founders.
Well, we're really happy to be back. It's our chosen home, and Katrina obviously brought an end to that, and we've been trying now for 3 years to get back to New Orleans, and we had an opportunity to partner up with the Museum of Southern Food and Beverage, Liz Williams, wonderful organization. We're in a beautiful 13,500 square foot space on the Mississippi River at the end of Canal Street in that famous Riverwalk Marketplace. It was built during the World's Fair. It's an extraordinary space, a beautiful exhibit designed by Ted Dr. Cocktail Hay, our curator. Ted is in the movie business. He's a designer in the movies, but his avocation is cocktail history, and he's got an extraordinary collection, which actually makes up a good two-thirds of what's in the museum, along with the collections of myself and several of the other founding members.
It's been rough 3 or 4 years for you guys, right?
Yeah. We had a home in New Orleans, and then we had a home in Las Vegas. You know, I have to tell you, there must be something in the water down there in New Orleans, but the Brennan family and all the restaurant community just embraced us from day one. When we opened at the Pharmacy Museum, a truck pulled up, and out came a Crest Corps, six waiters, and a chef who helped us open our first space down there as a generous gift from the Brennan family, Cafe Adelaide Commander's Palace. They have become such great friends of the museum and backed us and become friends personally of our founding members as well. And the whole community has reached out to us. And by the way, I think the museum will become a major attraction in New Orleans over the next several years.
What can people see when they come to the museum?
It's a timeline. It starts at the turn of the 18th to the 19th century with that first famous definition of the cocktail. Strong spirits of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters. Bitters being the defining ingredient that separated it from the slings and the punches that preceded it. We start there. There's a few 18th century items. I got a distilling guide from my collection that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson used, the same one, called the Practical Distiller. It's a magnificent, very rare 18th century distiller's guide. Then you move on to the different stages of the business. You know, when it was a novelty in the beginning of the 19th century, into the middle of the 19th century when technology and immigration made this cocktail bar, saloon sort of thing a reality. Technology, that is to say, artificial ice, gas in water, and flavored, you know, soda, pushing beer through lines with gas, all those technological advances, the column still, all the things that made cheap, inexpensive ice spirits available to a general population. Plus, all those Eastern Europeans, Scotsmen, Irishmen who wound up in the big cities in the northeast of the United States, bringing with them their communal drinking habits from the beer halls of Eastern Europe and Germany and the pubs and taverns of Scotland, Ireland, and England. And they continued that in their ghettos right here in New York, Philadelphia, Boston. And that became the sort of core of what is the cocktail bar business today. And then we go in, of course, into the golden age, 1860 to 1880, when all the greats, the Manhattan, the Martini, the Julep, the Fizzy, were invented, or they were sour, or they were perfected. And then into the decline by 1912, of course, when three-quarters of the states went dry, and then 1919, the big mistake. And it chronicles this, and then the return, the tropics, the tiki stage. It's an extraordinary story, and it's a part of American culture that people don't realize and don't understand to the extent it's become a part of our lives, how we celebrate our births and our deaths and our weddings and all of our significant events. The cocktail is really it's almost a metaphor for the American people. It's a composite beverage made up of all the traditions from the old world, all put together in that beautiful cocktail glass. and it's a composite beverage, and we're a composite people. It makes perfect sense to me that that would be our beverage tradition in this country.
And it is something that America gave the world, really. It's sort of like jazz music in some ways.
During Prohibition, what did we do? We exported the cocktail overseas. All of our greats, Harry Craddock, Harry McAlone, to name two of the most great. Harry Craddock, who wrote the famous Savoy Cocktail Bar book, he worked right here in New York City. He ended up at the Savoy in New York, in London. Harry McAlone worked right here in New York City at the Plaza Hotel. He ended up running Harry's New York Bar in Paris. A lot of our greats in Cuba, Sloppy Joe's, those American bar owners who packed up lock, stock, and barrel and headed down to Havana. So, yeah, we exported the drink to the world during Prohibition, and they've returned it in tenfold to us with the great cocktails like the Sidecar and the Singapore Sling. And
New Orleans is not normally thought of as a whiskey town, but that would be wrong, wouldn't it? That would be an incorrect perception.
Absolutely wrong. You're right. It started Spanish and then French, and of course they were big. That first Sazerac might have been a brandy Peychaud bitters drink, because Sazerac de Forgefi was a brand of French cognac that was imported to New Orleans. That's where the name came from. But very rapidly in the 19th century, it became an American town, and we were Americans, were whiskey drinkings, and they were drinking rye, to tell you the truth, and that came all the way from Pennsylvania. And then they became bourbon drinkers as well, but rye was their first love. I mean, that first Sazerac was made with rye whiskey and Peychaud's bitters, not bourbon whiskey. So yeah, that was the transition from a French-Spanish town to a real American town, you know.
But Bourbon Street is still named after the French bourbons and not the Kentucky bourbons.
So is our American whiskey named after those same people. It was the help that the French gave us in the Revolutionary War that made us want to name every damn thing after them. Lafayette Street, you know. Paris, Indiana. I mean, you know, are you kidding me? I mean, our streets in every city has a half a dozen French street names. And that all goes back to the Revolutionary War when the French helped us against the English. You know.
But that's why it's in New Orleans and not someplace else. For the it makes a perfect place to have the museum.
We're there because the town is drenched in tradition and history. We're there because there are iconic American cocktails: the Ramos Gin Fizz, the Brandy Milk Punch, the Sazerac, the Pousse Café, that come from that town. And even the Pimm's Cup somehow made it from the old world, first to New Orleans and then to the rest of the country. It's an extraordinary place, and the industry thrives there because of their after Prohibition. Unlike most of the other states, they didn't go crazy with regulations. You know, you can get a liquor license for $500 in New Orleans. You know, you can operate a place and make good money. You know, it's not like the control states and the places where they make it so hard for the suppliers and for the purveyors. So
I have to ask, for people from outside of New Orleans who are still wondering how things are a couple of years after Katrina, how are things, and is it a place where tourists can come now?
Let me tell you that the French Quarter and the Garden District and those areas, you won't realize that anything ever happened. The big hotels are all back open again. However, having said that, the whole Ninth Ward, east of the city, is still a devastated neighborhood. It looks like a bombed-out zone after the war. There are huge tracts. There are approximately 180,000 to 220,000 people that never came back to New Orleans. The demographic of the town has changed, and it's changing dramatically from day to day. There is a huge influx of Central and South American and Mexican Hispanics coming in, taking the jobs that a lot of the folks who never came back for one reason or another. And so that has changed Mardi Gras. There are whole crews that are gone now because those neighborhoods were wiped out. And that's sad. You know, that was a part of history. That was a part of the tradition of the town. Nothing against the Hispanics. It's wonderful that they have great jobs and a good place to come. But sad on the sense that we've lost what was part of the tradition of the city that I don't think will ever come back.
and it's a city that does need tourism dollars.
Yeah, everything's wide open. I mean, you'll see now that a lot of the conventions are coming back. It's open for business again, without a doubt. You know, the workers are coming in droves, and they're. The hard part is finding a place to live, frankly, because, as I said, those neighborhoods are not being reestablished. A lot of those neighborhoods are gone. So,
where can people get more information about the museum?
www.museumoftheamericancocktail.org. That's one long word. I'll repeat it. www.museumoftheamericancocktail.org.
I can't let you go without getting one good cocktail recipe for whiskey.
Well, the Sazerac is my favorite. I might as well tell you that one. You start with two, and this is the tradition in New Orleans. You start with two rocks glasses, old-fashioned glasses, whatever you want to call them. Right away, you fill one with crushed ice and set it aside. You take that second glass, you put some Peychaud's bitters, about five good dashes, I like a lot, or four, in the bottom of that with a little cube of sugar, and you take your muddler and you turn that into a paste in the bottom of that glass. You throw some ice cubes in and you pour in a hefty shot of rye whiskey. You stir that around really good until it's completely amalgamated and well chilled. You take that other glass. You dump the crushed ice out. You splash a good portion of absinthe, which we can now get legally in this country, thank God, into the bottom of the glass. You toss it up in the air with a little spin while you yell, Sazerac, and then you catch it. That has effectively coated the inside of the glass with absinthe. You dump out any residue that might be in the bottom of the glass. Then you transfer, straining off the ice, that chilled. Then you twist a lemon over the top of it, and you have this extraordinarily chilled drink without ice cubes that warms up slowly that you sip, by the way. It's a sipping drink like the julep. And as it warms up, the pepper and the spice of the bourbon and the oil in the lemon and the multiple botanicals and spices in the Peychaud's, and everything starts to slowly unfold, and it changes and just develops in the glass in such a beautiful way. The Sazerac cocktail.
You'll find a link to the museum's website at the Whiskey Cast website. And it's important to note that I talked with Dale well before Hurricane Gustav formed. As I'm recording this week's episode, Gustav is still a couple of days away from landfall somewhere along the Gulf Coast, and New Orleans is right in the storm's path. That's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. You'll find links, whiskey ratings, the calendar of events, the Whiskey Cast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the Whiskey Cast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.